Welcome to the Hannah Miller Show. And here she is, Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian. This is Hannah Miller, and this is what happened this week. So first of all, I apologize. I think my producer salvaged my audio from last week. He's incredible. Thanks, Bob, for doing that. That was my fault. If you noticed, there was a difference. I made a mistake on my recording side of things. So anyway, I apologize for that. Huge props to my producer for saving it and making it way better than it was originally. The second thing is, this week I'm recording earlier than I typically do in the week. I have two funerals this week, back to back, during my normal recording and thinking, pulling notes together time. And so I'm having to bump up a little earlier into the week when I record this and when I've done all the work for this. And so if something happens at the later part of the week and you're like, wait a minute, why didn't she talk about that? That's why we had a good friend of the family whose wife passed away, and we have her funeral this weekend. And then my husband's grandfather passed away this week, and we have his funeral this weekend as well, or towards the end of the week. So it just kind of complicates everything. So anyway, if something happens that and you're wondering why I didn't cover it, that is the reason why. It's because I had to record a little bit earlier this week because of the two events that we have going on. So this week, though, what I primarily want to cover, and what we're really just going to hunker down into one story, and that is the Iowa Family Leader Conference. Because I want to give some, I have some comments about the interviews that happened, and then some overall comments about the importance of this event. And I'm going to talk about those at the end. Because first, I don't typically watch presidential debates. Over the years, when in a presidential, when they do their speeches, when they do their debates, I mean, I'll tune in for a little bit, or I'll flip it on and off. But it's not really something that I watch, because typically I find them rather meaningless most of the time. But it was amazing with what happened at the Iowa Family Leader Conference to see what can be accomplished in a one-on-one format by a skilled interrogator, and that would be Tucker Carlson, revealed that it's quite different than the typical meaningless debate. Because we come into these debates, and it's a lot of times, I mean, what was it less? I'm like, 16 candidates. I mean, you have a dozen candidates and are participants, and they have these little snippets that they say. They have these one-liners that they've memorized. They're getting grilled by somebody who's on the far left. So they're not, a lot of times, they're not being asked the questions that are pertinent to you and I as Republicans, as conservatives, as those on the right. They're always being asked the questions kind of coming from the left, from now I really can't even say the middle ground. A lot of times it's not even middle ground stuff. It's really is from the left. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But this was very, it was very meaningful. And it really revealed some, a lot about these candidates. And in my opinion, we saw two go down in flames, at least two. And I'm going to point out and talk about a couple of different things that happened with each candidate and give some overviews with some of them. So this was at the Iowa Family Leader Conference. Tucker Carlson interviewed several leading contenders for president. That would be Tim Scott, Asa Hutchinson, Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, Vivek, and Ron DeSantis. And so if the participants thought, you know, if they kind of went into this, now personally, I don't think that they thought this. I don't think that they thought they were going to get some softballs just kind of lobbed over the plate. You know, if they thought that, they were certainly surprised, because for the most part, Tucker Carlson asked really hard questions, and some of their answers exposed their muddled thinking. And in my opinion, at least two of them, Asa Hutchinson and Mike Pence, went down in just a blaze of inglorious pusillanimity. And if you haven't had the opportunity to listen to all of the interviews on the site, I'll summarize some of the highlights for you. So, first of all, Pence. Tucker chided Pence for being more concerned about defending Ukraine. And this is something that I've talked about before with Mike Pence, that this was going to be a this was not a good look for him, that this was a bad, you know, he was not smart in championing Ukraine. And Tucker went after him for that. And his being more concerned with Ukraine than dealing with domestic problems. And you've probably seen the clip where Tucker said, "Where's the concern for the United States?" And Pence, you know, he just had asked him, you know, why are you more concerned about Ukraine? I'll give you a little bit more context. Why are you more concerned about Ukraine than, for example, our southern border? And he runs through a quick list of how crime is on the rise. No city in America is safer today than it was 3 years ago. You know, kind of runs through this list. And then he says, "Where's the concern for the United States?" And then Pence kind of pushes back and says, "That's not my concern, Tucker. I've heard this routine from you before, and that's not my concern." And so that clip, though, has really made the rounds on social media. And Pence has tried to duck this gaffe by claiming that it was out of context. But the video is undoctored. The response is clear. And I believe personally that his campaign is totally dead. Although, like I said, his support for Ukraine was incredibly out of touch and would be a major nail in the coffin of his presidential campaign. And I've thought that for quite a few weeks now. He did try to cover for the gaffe, though. They put out, you know, like a total clip, and this is what else he had to say following that. And so, because I want to be fair, let me tell you what his defense was, the argument that he made right after he said, "That's not my concern." Because he said, "Anybody that says that we can't be the leader of the free world and solve our problems at home has a pretty small view of the greatest nation on earth. We can do both. And as president of the United States, we will secure our border, we will support our military, we will revive our economy and stand by our values. We will also lead the world for freedom under my administration, I promise you." And so that was his argument, that the defense, as the kind of the cover-up that he tried to bring out and point to and say, "Look, we're bigger, we're the greatest nation on earth, we can blah, 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 blah." And so much of that, "We're going to secure our border, we will support our military, we'll revive our economy, we'll stand by our values." You could not get more 2002 Republican. I mean, you know, this is the Republican Party of bygone days. That is the synopsis of Mike Pence. He really is a picture of the Republican Party of bygone days. This is not the Republican Party that people want anymore. This is vague, okay? And you're going to contrast these statements with another candidate later on in our analysis here. And essentially, he said the same thing as Tim Scott. That Tim Scott said when Tucker Carlson grilled Scott about the southern border versus Ukraine, because he, you know, Tim Scott's all about supporting Ukraine and blah, blah, blah. And Scott said, "We can walk and chew gum at the same time." And he's trying to say we can protect our borders and Ukraine's borders simultaneously. The problem, and you have to forgive me, my voice has been a little off this week. The problem here for both these guys is that most Americans want the president of the United States of America to have a clear priority of America first. We are no longer, like I said, the Republican Party of the bygone days. We want a very clear America first agenda. And we don't want to be beat up about having an America first agenda. Let's get things straightened up here. Let's protect Americans at the southern border. Let's do something about all the fentanyl coming across from Mexico before we start worrying about everybody else. Yes, we believe America is a phenomenal country and that two things can be done at the same time. But we do still want a president whose first priority is the protection and prosperity of U.S. citizens. Look, the scriptures tell us in 1 Timothy 5:8 to care for our own homes first. It's not anti-Christian to prioritize our own families, homes, and country. In truth, it is biblical. It is biblical to take care of our families first, our own homes. And you know what the reality is? That when we have safety, when we have protection and prosperity here in the United States, we then export those things. But when we have instability here, we export instability. That's the reality. Because the United States of America, a country, is just the family on a grander scale. And if the family is not prosperous, if the family doesn't feel safe, you know, if the relationship between the mom and dad, those things are, their relationship is exported to their children. And then their children and what's going on in their family is then exported into their church and their community, which is then exported into their culture, which is then exported. I mean, you know what I'm saying? And we long say that the family, you know, that politics is downstream of the culture, and the culture is downstream of the family, and the family is downstream of the father. Actually, I didn't say that right. The culture is downstream of the church, and the church is downstream of the family. I'm sorry. And then the family is downstream of the father. So, you know, all of those things, the result of that is that means whatever the father exports to his family, that is then exported to the church, which is then exported to the culture, which is then exported to politics, which is then exported to the world. Okay? That's what I'm trying to say here. And so it's not a bad thing to first be concerned with our own family, with our own homes, with our own countries, because that's just how nature works, and it's actually biblical. All right, so let's go back to the leadership conference, the leader conference in Iowa. Asa Hutchinson was asked if he'd changed his opinion after he vetoed an Arkansas bill. So there was an Arkansas bill that he vetoed that banned transgender surgical treatment for children, okay? The bill made what it called an exception for some intersex people with unspecified chromosomal makeup and hormone production, and those with difficulties resulting from previous gender-affirming treatments. It also would have banned so-called cross-hormone therapy, a gender-affirming treatment that allows for trans people to change their physical appearance to be more consistent with their gender identity. Tucker noted that hormonal treatment of children created a permanent alteration, as did surgical intervention, and that Hutchinson forbade restricting surgery and cross-hormonal therapy. How do you feel 2 years later about hormonal treatments? How do you change his mind? Did he change his opinion? What's been his thinking since then? Because there's been, you know, kind of tried to give him an out here, because it's been in the last 2 years, it's become very obvious that the majority of Americans do not support this kind of thing. And there's been a surge of legislation across the country banning this kind of thing in red states. Had he changed his mind? Hutchinson, in my opinion, did not offer a satisfactory answer, probably because he couldn't. He began by saying God says there are two sexes, but then continued that parents have a right to change that. And the response was, in my opinion, just incredibly muddled. It was unconvincing. And so I think that on such a big issue for Americans right now, that means that he's another candidate that's out of the race. So those are the two, I think, that really got pushed out of the race as a result of these two interviews, their interviews with Tucker Carlson at the leader conference. So then as for Nikki Haley. So I didn't get to watch every minute of all of these, but Clarence Feldman over at American Thinker, she had a pretty good summary for Nikki Haley, and I'm in agreement with her when I think he was a bit softer on Haley, letting her off harder questions on her hawkish views of Ukraine. He didn't nail her as hard as he probably could have. She did overall, she showed a lot of political savvy and poise. Nevertheless, and I'm in agreement with Feldman here too, I did not think she did well on the questions of climate change, and she fudged on the question of whether she thought that 2020 was a fair election, deflecting to a plea about achieving election integrity. She said there were a lot of irregularities, but didn't think it affected the results, even though she agreed that the intelligence community had too much power and interfered with the 2020 election. So, you know, trying to kind of toe that line of, in my opinion, appeasing. She's trying to appease everybody in the Republican Party, folks who say, no, there was no, you know, there was no stealing of the election. It was a fair election. And then those who would say, no, it wasn't a fair election. She's trying to toe that line. And that's one of the phrases that a lot of these guys are, they like to throw out. is like, hey, we should always strive for election integrity, but they're not really willing to say that 2020 had a lot, it was not a fair election, and that there was a lot of issues there, and that it did affect the final results. They're not willing to say that, and she wasn't either. Now, she displayed some great managerial instincts and was great on cleaning out agencies and the Department of Justice, and she has a record to back that up, which she described, so she did great on all of those. So anyway, I'm not going to go into all of the details for everything. I think primarily the climate change stuff was what she was kind of weak on regarding the Paris Climate Agreement, all of that. So I'm not a fan of Nikki. Never have been really in recent years, or I have not been in recent years. So anyway, that's kind of a summary of her. She came out looking pretty strong. Nothing really, really kind of knocked her out of the playing field, in my opinion. But not a whole lot to like really put her up above the rest of the fray. So let's talk about Vivek. He's kind of came out of nowhere. But he's a very smart, very successful businessman. He's the only millennial he's in the race. And he was very impressive. And I have found him to be impressive on other occasions when I've heard him speak. He began by saying Americans were, quote, starved for purpose and meaning. Things like patriotism, hard work, and family. And widespread depression, suicide, transgenderism are symptoms of this. We have, he believes, an opportunity to fill that vacuum with more than race, sex, and transgenderism. We have a moral hunger. Those are words that he used. And he called for a return, a turn away from globalism and return to nationalism. He was firm on Ukraine, contending there's no basis for sending our military to secure some other country's border while neglecting our own. He was critical of the support the war has received from both parties, which appear to feel that we have a politically correct war while ignoring the fact that it has actually, among other things, strengthened the Russia-China alliance, which is the, in his opinion, was the worst threat. He offered up his ideas for a negotiated settlement that includes a promise not to add Ukraine to NATO and allows Russia some territory. So he wanted to be able to compromise, kind of come up with a compromise for the two countries. And then, interestingly enough, unlike those who blame Trump for the January 6th events, he blames the Biden administration big tech censorship. This is what he said. He said, "You want to know what caused J6? Private censorship in this country in the lead up to J6. We were told you could not question where the virus came from. We were told that you could not send a private message to someone on the eve of an election that Hunter Biden's laptop story was true. You were told you had to be locked down. You had to take a vaccine that was mandated while Antifa and Black Lives Matter roam and burn the streets. That's what caused January 6th, a cycle of censorship," which was a very interesting take, although he didn't condemn January 6th, and he didn't clearly state that this was not something that was incited by Donald Trump, and it wasn't something that the folks who've been imprisoned, and he didn't really talk about any of that. So it was kind of an interesting take. I would agree with his take on that, but I would like to see these candidates talking about what's happening with the J6 prisoners and the injustice that's happening there. He made a lot of striking statements that I think really appeal to people. He said, "True privilege is not based on the color of your skin. It's being raised in a stable family with two parents with a focus on education and a faith in God. That's the ultimate privilege." And then he said, "Math isn't racist, but you know what might be? Not teaching black kids how to do math." And overall, I think that Vivek came away very strong from the conference. I think he's been building a lot of momentum. I think a lot of that's because he's very motivational and inspiring as a speaker, with lots of poignant comments about hot button issues. He's really able to, he's a very effective communicator. And so I think he actually was the one that walked away from the conference as being the best communicator and having communicated his ideas the best. A lot of the other guys were kind of muddled their way through, and that would be Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Asa Hutchinson, Mike Pence, a lot of these other lifetime politicians. And that's because they got they were in the hot seat with Tucker Carlson, and he was asking them questions that they just probably weren't prepared for. And so, anyway, like I said, Vivek, I think he's just very inspiring. I think he's got a lot of really good one-liners. How that actually would manifest into policy, I don't know. Just because you're very motivational and you know how to be an orator doesn't mean necessarily that you'd make a good politician. And the problem for me with Vivek is primarily is that he's Hindu. And as a religious person, he understands the dire need for Americans to have a morality based in religion and to have a purpose outside of ourselves. But ultimately, it's not just any religion that we should have our morality based in. And he will direct Americans to a morality and purpose found in the Hindu religion versus Christianity. And as a country that was founded upon Christian principles, I do not think it will ultimately benefit us to have someone of another religion leading our nation. Because when Vivek says we need purpose outside of ourselves, what purpose will he point us to? Not the purpose of glorifying the God of the Bible, surely. Surely not. And so I find that to be problematic. He also, back in, I think it was April. Could have been July. I don't know. It was spring, summer of 2020. He supported mask mandates and came out. There was a tweet that I saw this weekend of his supporting the mask mandates. And I would like to have somebody question him on that, on whether or not he changed his mind about that. What did he mean by that? Did he just mean, hey, yeah, I support mask mandates from the government, or did he just support the idea of everybody masking up for the betterment of everybody else? Like, you know, because there's a big difference between just saying, hey, I support people wearing a mask and choosing to do that on their own versus I support the government stepping in and requiring and mandating masks. There's a big difference, and his tweet, his comments about that were kind of vague at the time, or it wasn't very clear which he meant, and I would like to know that, and if he changed his mind or not in the time since. All right, Ron DeSantis, he also came out pretty well in his interview. As governor of Florida, he signed a bill that banned abortion after 6 weeks. And said he'd also use presidential bully pulpit to encourage more governors to pass more restrictive abortion laws. He acknowledged that this must be done by the consensus in each state. He wasn't trying to be totalitarian coming from the federal government on this. As for global warming, which I found this one interesting, he said he concentrated on improving the environment, which actually impacts people's lives, and that forcing people into electric vehicles is not going to work. And I appreciated that in his comments about it. And I'm going to try to do a follow-up episode here in a couple weeks talking about electric vehicles and talking about it with my husband and some things that have happened recently, because the whole electric vehicle thing has come back up in the news, and it's worth talking about a little bit more. Question about whether he was concerned that all the immigrants into his state from California and New York would turn his red state blue. He responded that that's not happening, that most of the new residents, you know, they wanted to move away from the insanity they were leaving behind and wanted more traditional values. And then he kind of chided our government's foreign policy leaders, saying we need to concretely define the mission there. And moreover, we must decide what is in our national interest, our border or Ukraine's. And then he was quite adamant about the invasion across our borders, and in particular, the need to smash the cartels. And of course, this affects him directly, because there's a lot of folks who go from the border to Florida. And so he sees a lot of the negative consequences of having an open border at the southern border. And specifically, he said we need to focus more on the threat from China, stop providing at our cost blanket security to Europe in the war in Ukraine, and stop giving Iran a free pass. all of that was very interesting to me because as somebody who has only governed at on the state level, I have been interested to hear what he had to say about things on more of a global international relations aspect. And so all of that was appealing to me, and I was in agreement with the comments that he made there. And then he was asked about cryptocurrency and the Federal Reserve's plan to rid us of cash. And he said he'd nix any such plan, which he sees as a means to impose a social credit system on this country. And I thought that was really interesting because, see, a lot of politicians aren't willing to call it what it is and say that kind of thing and recognize the purpose, the end goal of some of these things. And for him to be willing to come out and say, nah, this is a social credit system and the means by which they plan to implement social credit system, I appreciated that. I appreciated his honesty and his willingness to just say it how it is. And then as for the intelligence community and other agencies which sabotaged the chief executive, as we've seen, he said he'd immediately name a new FBI director and fill all executive branch positions which do not require confirmation on the first day. And that anticipating media outrage if he did this, he said Article 2 of the Constitution gives the president that power. Furthermore, he would have used that power to fire Fauci and those government employees who colluded in censorship, and this was key, and that on a case-by-case basis, he'd pardon those who were targeted by a partisan Department of Justice. That was the thing that, for me, was very important, and I was very glad to hear him address and somebody say, look, I'm going to look at this two-tier justice that we've had going on, and I'm going to try to step in and do something about it. And of course, then, you know, for him as the governor of Florida, we know he's been a leader on the COVID issue. And he added that government censorship on COVID, he just claimed, flat out said, it killed people and it hurt school children. And without a major accounting, this weaponization of government would happen again. And he's exactly right on that. And so I would like to know more about what his thinking is on what a major accounting would be and how he would implement that if he became the president of the United States, because it needs to happen. There needs to be a major accounting for what happened with COVID government censorship on COVID and during COVID. And then he talked about agencies classifying information and in order to protect themselves, and that being a big problem, and saying he would declassify as much as possible, requiring agencies to meet a high bar to block declassification. So in conclusion, and I know I just kind of like spat all of that out at you fast, I'm trying to get this done so I don't totally lose my voice. I'm afraid it's going to totally go out on me before I get done. But in conclusion, regarding the interviews themselves, this is a far better method of letting voters know about the candidates than what is ridiculously called debates. This large number of participants with predictable questions that come from biased moderators, typically leftist moderators, followed by short, scripted responses and one-liner sound bites that these guys have memorized that really give us no insight into what their policies would actually be and what their thinking actually is regarding some of these issues. And as Feldman said in her article, she said, no serious candidate should continue to participate in those kind of debates, and no intelligent voter should bother watching them. And I agree, and it's kind of why I really haven't done much watching of them over the last few election cycles, because I've found them to be mostly meaningless. And then second, in overall, regarding this whole format and what happened here, Tucker Carlson's interviews with the presidential candidates was monumental, in my opinion, in two ways. First, it was not hosted on a major network television station. Rather, it was on alternative media, Blaze Media. They were the platform that hosted this event, and it went off seamlessly. It was perfect. That's That's another major nail in the coffin for cable news. How we consume information is drastically changing in front of our eyes. And kudos to both The Blaze and Tucker Carlson for being willing to take this on, because it was a pretty big undertaking. But they did it, and it went so smoothly. And it just was really the better way for voters to get to hear from candidates. And so in my opinion, so that's the first way that it was very monumental. And the second way is because of Tucker and what he did and what he was allowed to do by The Blaze. And that is what, and he did what we call punching from the right. He punched from the right. And this is universally disliked within the Republican Party because it's seen as divisive, while the Democrats are always in lockstep. And it's true, the Democrats are always in lockstep. But when Republicans are only interviewed or have debates only moderated by the left or somebody that's center left, they only get hit from the left. So as Steve Dace said recently, they always look like a hero. You know, because they're not insane, they always look like, they always come out of it smelling like roses. And always getting questions from the far left means that as long as they sound semi-coherent and reasonable, they will always seem like the better choice by those of us on the right. But there's a lot of ground. I want you to hear me. There's a lot of ground between the left of today and between true conservatism. While on the surface, it seems to make sense that we should avoid causing division in the Republican Party, the long-term consequences of our unwillingness to hold Republican candidates to true conservative standards, to avoid this punching from the right, is that we have ended up with politicians who are held to leftist standards and who are, quote, not as bad as the other guy. And the thinking that any Republican is better than a Democrat. Of course, it's true they're not crazy leftists some of the time, but that doesn't mean they're staunch conservatives who are going to stand up for your and my values. That's become all too obvious in recent years. Just because Lindsey Graham doesn't have a D by his name doesn't mean he's going to stand staunchly for America First policies and stand for the Constitution. That's a joke. It actually is our responsibility to expose the posers, to cut them out of the Republican Party in order for the Republican Party to be more cohesive, more cohesively conservative. Because I don't care if we have a cohesive Republican Party if they're not conservative, if they're not Americanist, if they don't share my values. I don't care. I don't want them to be cohesively middle ground or whatever it is. And a lot of them are center left even, because we've been unwilling to hold their feet to the conservative fire and hold them to a standard to the right. Because, oh, we can't cause division. Oh, everybody's got to be in unity. Well, who cares if we're in unity, if we're all in agreement that we're going to totally ignore what's going on at the southern border and we're going to go to Ukraine? And I'm totally losing my voice right now, so I better wrap this up. Anyway, my whole point is that this is important, and it was important. What Tucker Carlson and The Blaze Media did was important, was crucial for politics in America, for voters in America. Because it allowed us to actually see and hear what these candidates stand for in a broader and more detailed way. And it allows for us to build a Republican Party that is more cohesively conservative. And that's the only way we win, as far as having our values be defended by our politicians, is if we demand, if we hold them to a conservative standard, and we build a Republican Party that's more cohesively conservative. Not just cohesive, not just working in unity with one another, because they could be working in unity on anything and have any value that I don't agree with. So this is the way. This is the way forward. And as Feldman said, serious candidates should forego these debates with 10, 12, 14 candidates. Sit down in this kind of a situation, be willing to answer hard questions, and let voters know what their policies would be and what their thinking is regarding hard issues that we care about. And intelligent voters, we should not give any kind of attention to these debates that are just full of one-liners and dippy statements that have been memorized. So kudos to The Blaze, kudos to Glenn Beck and Tucker Carlson, and really these candidates who went on and were willing to be interviewed because they had to have known this was not going to be easy, that they were not going to get off easy on this. And they did it anyway, so kudos to them. And we'll see what happens in the coming days with this one. You have a great weekend, and hopefully my voice is back with us next week.
Thank you for listening to The Hannah Miller Show. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is produced by Bob Sloan Audio Productions. If you'd like to find out more about Hannah or to schedule her for a speaking event, go to her website, thehannahmillershow.com.